The conference is now being recorded.
Okay, we are now officially being recorded, and this will be posted on the website, so you can tell your attorneys that weren't there today, or your pro bonos, or you know anyone that needs the ethics credit, that this will be posted to our website. And it takes a couple of weeks, but it will be up there in the near future. I'm happy today to introduce David Silverstein. You probably know David. You've hopefully attended one of his trainings in the past. I know that ethics credits are something that are sought after by our attorneys, and I get many requests for those, and we've had some other folks do them, but we keep coming back to David because, frankly, his trainings are just the best. I'm going to, with that, hand it over to David. I do want to remind everyone that the materials were sent out. You are going to need to have the materials open in front of you. So if you don't have them open, go ahead and pull those out and get those open. And also, again, hopeful that people will volunteer when David asks for participation, so please speak up. And if you want to say your name first, that would help David then probably communicate with you. And we won't hopefully have to go to calling on the circuits, but if we do, you know, that will, if you can just speak up then once your circuit is called upon. So if you don't have the materials for some reason, feel free, you know, to shoot me an email right now and I'll be happy to make sure they get to you. Okay, David, it's all you.
All right, well, thank you very much, and thank you, everyone, for sharing your lunch with me today. And I'm sure that everyone's hungry for ethics professionalism. For ethics. All right. Everyone's on mute, so I can't hear the laughing. Anyway, you can unmute to laugh. I would first like to let you all know I've been doing this work for almost 19 years, you know, being in court every day and doing a lot of trials. You end up facing a lot of ethics and professionalism issues, both in your own practice, you know, you handling the case, and also with the issues that you deal when you're going against parents' attorneys or dealing with the DCF attorneys or attorney ad litem. And I would first like to recognize all of you and thank you for all the great work that you do throughout the years. I remember even my first trial. If I didn't have such a great guardian ad litem attorney, Brad Bobbitt, helping me with my first trial in this work, which was an expedited termination of parental rights case, if I didn't have his help, I wouldn't have survived at all. And you all do a tremendous job, and you're a great help to me, to the DCF attorneys, and to the whole system. So thank you. Mary Kay said, what we're going to do is we're going to go through a scenario that I put together, discuss the ethical and professionalism issues. First, and this is for participation, what is ethics? What are attorney ethics? Anybody want to tackle that? All right, come on. You can do it.
Hi, this is Elizabeth in the 10th Judicial Circuit. Ethics is something that's mandated by the rules of... I have a bit of a cold. But... it's standards of conduct to treat other parties and people in litigation with professionalism without doing anything underhanded, without appearance of something underhanded or unethical being done, basically.
Very good. Well, that's perfect. I mean, ethics are standards of conduct as attorneys, and what they establish is the minimum standards. If you follow these minimum standards, you will probably stay out of trouble, be able to retain your bar license. Don't meet the minimum standards of conduct, you may have some problems with your bar license. So what's professionalism? Anybody want to tackle that? Explain what professionalism is. Okay, well, I will help you then. Professionalism, where ethics is the minimum standard of conduct, professionalism is the highest standards of conduct. And those are the standards of conduct that we should all strive to attain. So we have our ethics rules. The bar also is very big on professionalism. And professionalism, although there are professionalism standards, you know it. You know it when you see it. There's also, so as far as dictating your conduct, we do have ethics and professionalism. There are two other documents or concepts that govern your conduct as guardian ad litem attorneys. And that is guardian ad litem program attorney standards, and then your just general guardian ad litem program standards of operation. So not only are you required as a guardian ad litem attorney to be familiar with your ethics and professionalism precepts, but you also need to thoroughly read your program attorney standards of operation. So what we're going to do, we're going to start going through the scenario. And we're going to go through this scenario, and I will stop at some point by issue as Carlisle, Father Gordon Sumner. We got the children, Andy Summers and Stuart Copeland. We got an aunt, Jane Weedland. Charlotte Effie, Grace Wing, the guardian ad litem, Carol, guardian ad litem attorney, Shock, the department attorney.
David, what I'm going to do is someone doesn't have their phone on mute and they're outside and it's windy, I think, so I'm going to mute the whole line and then I'll take it off when we're ready for questions, okay?
It looks like someone corrected
Oh, they took care of it. Great.
Yeah,
okay.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you, whoever just did that.
All right, so here's the situation that we have. On November 7th of 2011, Andy and Stuart get removed from their parents, Belinda and Gordon, due to the parents' abuse of cocaine and their domestic presence of their children. Apartment places both children in licensed foster care. Then the next day, there was a shelter petition filed by the department, and it also alleged that Belinda's four other children were removed due to her cocaine abuse and homelessness, and also that she had her parental rights involuntarily terminated in 2008 due to her continued abuse of crack cocaine, failed to complete treatment at three different drug treatment facilities, and then Lita Ford, the mother's cousin, adopted the children. All right, on November 8th, we had the shelter hearing. The court appoints regional counsel to both parents, and then the judge says to Tom, says, who's the father? She says that it's Gordon, is the father of both children. However, he was not at the shelter hearing. Then we have Kathy Valentine, an attorney from Florida Legal Aid. She comes in, and she walks in the shelter's hearing and just approaches the judge. And she and the judge have a hearing, a conversation that no one can hear for approximately 5 minutes. It ends with both of them laughing. And then she requested that the court appoint an attorney ad litem for the children. And then the judge immediately grants the request. So let's stop there and look at that. First of all, does anyone have any issues with what has gone on so far?
Yes, this is April Roll from the 17th Circuit. One of the issues I saw was that regional counsel was representing both parents.
Okay, and what is the problem with that?
first they may have a conflict of interest and they may have different positions on different issues.
Because of why?
Well, each of them, well, hold on 1 second.
Well, what makes them in conflict?
The domestic violence.
Right, very good. So what is your obligation as an attorney when the judge does that, appoint counsel to represent both parents in a domestic violence situation? What is your obligation?
This is Elizabeth from the 10th Judicial Circuit. I would advise the judge that there are allegations of domestic violence in the shelter petition and that there may be a conflict, and I would ask that an attorney from the private attorney will be appointed to represent one of the parents to avoid a conflict.
Good. Does anyone not think that it is your obligation to point that out to the judge or to the regional council? Well, that's good. Has anyone ever done that before?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we do that. And here in the 10th, usually the regional conflict council, even though they may not be appointed, they are given the shelter petition, so they themselves usually know that there's a conflict. But if it somehow misses the issue, or if there's some prior history that we may know from a different case, of course we'll tell the judge and tell regional conflict council that there's a problem.
Okay. Very good.
Well, this is April Roll from the 17th. I know later on in the scenario there's an issue with us being appointed, but usually before we make comments and suggestions, we make sure we're appointed. Otherwise, we're just officers of the court, friend of a court. But first, I would ask that we be appointed, and then I would definitely comment on that.
Okay, very good. That's excellent.
Yeah, this is Elizabeth from the 10th. I have a problem with somebody just barging in the hearing and just having a 5-minute private conversation with the judge without any explanation. There's some, especially since that's followed up with a request to be appointed as the attorney ad litem for the children, that would strongly indicate to me that there was some ex parte communication, which is inappropriate.
All right. So that's a very good point. So let's talk about first. You got Kathy walking in. She's chatting away with the judge. They're both laughing before the hearing. Is that an ethics issue or a professionalism issue?
This is Lorraine from the Second Circuit. I think it's more of a professionalism issue. It was completely unprofessional for both of them to engage in, you know, that type of casual behavior going in during a hearing and so on.
And why do you say that? What's the problem that you get?
Well, it does actually give an appearance of a conflict, but it's not necessarily a conflict of interest. If she's the attorney ad litem in the circuit that is generally appointed to the children at that stage, well, it's almost a given that she's going to be appointed anyhow as an attorney ad litem.
And what's that say to the mom that's sitting there?
Could you repeat that?
I'm sitting there watching this conversation go on between this attorney and the judge, and this attorney just got appointed. What's that saying to the mom?
Well, it doesn't look very good in terms of, you know, from the parents' perspective, because now they see that here's somebody who seems to have a very good relationship with the judge, and perhaps that's going to impact where, you know, the judge's approach to the parents. So the parents probably see, you know, the attorneys around may strike it down to bad behavior, unprofessionalism, but the parents may actually incorporate that as a bias against them.
Okay, so what do you do? How can you take care of that, or can you take care of that?
I think that's difficult to take care of that during a hearing.
Or how do you take care of it at all?
Well, I think if an attorney is doing, you know, presenting those behaviors on a consistent basis, then, you know, you could, I think, potentially file a complaint against them if
Well, but we said it was professionalism and not ethics, so...
That's true, that's true.
There's no bar complaint for professionalism. So, what would you do? Anybody have an idea?
Well, this is Elizabeth from the 10th. I mean, obviously, we could ask, you know, that if there was an ex parte communication, that that be shared with the other parties before we proceed.
Yeah, you're really going to tick off the judge. Judge is already ticked off.
Not okay. Anymore. Telling him, let's see what the first DCA will do about it.
we're not there yet. Hold on. All right.
Ms. Cathier, first, I would probably address this issue with our chief judge.
Really? Okay. How about this suggestion? How about just talking to Kathy after the hearing and saying, Kathy, did you realize that the mom was sitting right there when you were chatting away with the judge? Maybe I want to do that with the mom in the room. Or, you know, you may not want to do that when anyone else, if you're talking about something that's not case-related. Okay? Because remember, Rule 4-3.5, as far as the impartiality, you know, of and ex parte, that's the rule that deals with ex parte, you know, you want to make sure that you're not talking to the judge about the substance of the case. But if you're just asking a judge, hey, how'd your vacation go? I tried out that restaurant that you recommended for me. That's probably not going to be a violation, but it's concerning. So,
David, this is Hillary from the 17th. I was just wondering, by the judge permitting that conduct from the attorney, isn't the judge herself, violating the judicial canons too?
We're talking about a situation where, you know, we're very, you know, we work together with the same judges every day. We've become friendly with them. You know, that's not necessarily a bad thing, okay? But we just need to watch out with who's in the room when we're talking to not give that appearance of impropriety. So really good discussion, and I really appreciate the participation. Y'all are doing excellent. Okay, so anybody see any other issues? There's one really big issue that I want to make sure that y'all get. Who's not there?
Father.
Okay, and was there a very thorough inquiry as to his paternity status? The answer is no. There wasn't a thorough inquiry of his paternity status, and we need to make sure that is one of our big barriers of permanency is getting paternity issues resolved. So we need to make sure that we identify this man as the legal father. And that would be a competence issue as far as all the attorneys in the room under 4-1.1. Y'all agree?
Yes.
Okay. Please, y'all remember, when you're handling those shelters or arraignments, you gotta help us. I mean, because, you know, stuff goes on, like you get knocked off course because there's all this going on in the courtroom, and I forgot about the paternity issue. Well, we don't want to forget that, because you know what happens when we're at TPR time. It becomes a major issue. Okay, so let's move on. Then we got Carol King, the guardian attorney. She requests appoint the guardian ad litem program. Judge Houston says, why do I need to appoint the guardian ad litem? I just appointed an attorney ad litem. And Carol's response is, well, the law requires that you appoint us to the case, and the judge says, I'm not appointing the guardian. I want to save state money. And Carol, her response is, we'll see what the first DCA says about that. And then the judge becomes angry and screams. If you're going to waste money on an appeal, then let's waste state money on the guardian ad litem program. And then says, under duress, I'll appoint the guardian. And then Carol doesn't even respond and then laughs. Okay. So, y'all, tell me, ethical issues or professionalism, both, what?
Professionalism, I see. I mean, it's, I mean, laughing is just bad behavior. You know, I certainly a bad outburst about, let's see what the first DCA, of course, you know, if you disagree with a ruling, you know, the parties have a right to take an appeal, but you may not want to necessarily smack the judge in the face with that. I would have tried to explain the difference between an attorney ad litem and the guardian ad litem, because the two do have different functions. So I see this more as a professional issue, you know, with just people being horrible to each other, but maybe perhaps not crossing the line into ethics.
Okay. Anybody else? Is this an ethical issue?
This is Jennifer from the 8th. I see an ethical issue.
Okay, what is it?
Well, I mean, you have a duty of a certain amount of decorum to the court, and I think that, that her behavior did not meet that level of decorum that's due to the court.
Okay, and are you looking at any particular rule?
No, that's from my memory.
Okay. All right. Well, when you look at Rule 4-3.5, that's the impartiality and decorum of the tribunal. A says, lawyers shall not seek to influence a judge except as permitted by law or other rules of the court. Is threatening to go to the DCA, is that violating that provision of the rule?
No, I mean you're allowed to seek legal recourse, but there's a certain amount of respect that's due to the court, and there's an appropriate exchange between an attorney and the tribunal.
I disagree. This is Roberta from the 19th Circuit, and I think it's totally unethical to threaten an appeal. If you have grounds to appeal, then you just file your grounds to appeal, but I don't believe it's appropriate to, well, first, it's not appropriate to yell at a judge, but it's definitely not appropriate to say, well, that's your ruling, that's what we're going to do. You go back to the office, we have procedures to stop that, but that's not appropriate, influencing the judge to appoint you because you threatened to appeal.
So then you would think that that was a violation of Rule 4-3.5?
Correct.
Okay. And then also, you also have to watch out, and you know, some of these ethical rules, they're kind of worded in such general terms that don't deal with every specific situation, but also subsection C says disruption of tribunal. Lawyers shall not engage in conduct intended to disrupt a tribunal. And there could be an argument that, you know, threatening the judge with the appeal could be a disruption to the tribunal. So you got to watch out. And then, I mean, I think that it goes without saying. If the judge does something that upsets you, what is your response? What do you do?
File a motion for rehearing.
Okay, that'll make the judge real happy. No, I mean at the hearing. The judge is not going your way and not saying nice things to you. What do you do?
You still have to maintain composure and act like a professional. I mean, how many times, you know, you could argue a lengthy motion and the ruling comes down against you and you would still say thank you, judge, and, you know, deal with it through an appeal or through whatever other means you have available to you. But certainly... In this hypothetical, it appears to me that the judge is the one who's screaming, not the Carol. But you know, certainly, you wouldn't escalate it or do anything, you know, to get back at him. You know, it doesn't make sense. It's counterproductive. It wouldn't serve anything. He will do what he will, or she will do what she will do, and
you know, it depends on the circumstances, but I certainly wouldn't laugh or yell back at him or anything like that.
Right, very good. And also, if you look at the comment of 4-3.5, it says, a lawyer may stand firm against abuse by judge, but should avoid reciprocation. So let's move on. So now we got the department attorney, Gina Schock, who took testimony from the CPI. Guy's testifying. Regional counsel Charles objects based on hearsay. And then Carol just quickly responds, the court can consider any evidence to the extent of probative value. Gina, the DCF attorney, didn't respond. The judge overruled the objection, allowed the CPI to testify regarding the hearsay. And then Carol says loud whisper so all could hear, yes. Any issues with that?
Of course.
Yeah. I mean, that could, number one, someone could argue is disruptive to the tribunal, and yes. Also it's not very professional.
No.
But when we win, unfortunately in our cases, do we really win cases? These are not the types of cases where there's winners or losers, and there should be high fives and all that going on. All right, so let's move on. Gina, this is still in the shelter hearing, hands the judge photographs of the family home, which shows broken windows and furniture, holes in the wall. And Carol objected to the judge looking at the pictures because Gina failed to show Carol the photos first. And then Charles objected to the judge looking at the photographs for the same reason. And then the judge says to Carol, are you going to appeal me if I let you see the pictures after I see the pictures? And Carol responds, we will file a writ if you don't let me see the pictures. The judge threw the pictures at Carol, hitting Carol on the hand. And then Carol gets up and walks out. And the judge granted the shelter. All right. Ethical professionalism. Like I said, that threatening the judge with the writ or the appeal is ethical, professional. The judge threw pictures at Carol and hit her. And she just walks out.
Technically, the judge throwing something and hitting her is technically a battery, so completely unprofessional.
But we've
seen a judge do that in the courtroom. A judge threw her glasses and hit the father with the glasses. So I've actually seen that happen. But it's certainly not. That's probably a violation of the judicial canon. But. Walking out of the courtroom is, again, unprofessional.
Disruptive. Okay. What about the Carol getting up and walking out? The hearing wasn't done.
It wasn't done. It's unethical because basically she's, you know, getting hit with the pictures, I don't see this as imminent risk of harm where you have to flee for your life or something along those lines. So she's basically abandoning the representation of her client by leaving. So unethical.
Right. And also, what she did leaving may be disruptive. Someone may argue that her leaving was lessening the disruption.
The only thing I can say is I'm glad I don't practice in that courtroom.
And then how about the statement, I'm going to file a writ if I don't get to see the pictures first. Is there an ethical problem with that, filing a writ because the judge would not let you see the pictures first?
The threat of the appeal or saying that you're going to appeal, I didn't see that as crossing the line into the ethical, but I think this one does, you know.
Why? Why does it Why do you think this one crosses the line? I disagree with you. I think threatening an appeal is going to be a bar complaint, but on the record. But as far as threatening this writ, because couldn't see the pictures first.
Well, first of all, the way this reads is not even an appropriate response, because the judge is saying, will you appeal if I let you see the pictures after I see them? So he's not withholding the pictures. He's just letting her see the pictures after he sees them. And she's implying that he's refusing to let her see the pictures, the way I read this paragraph. I could be wrong.
No, you're right. Okay. So, come on. Let's pick out the ethical rule. It's unethical. Why is it unethical to threaten a writ on this issue?
Because this...
I think it is. What rule applies?
I don't have the number off the top of my head, but basically that's a threat over something that's not occurring, you know?
Well, there's Rule 4-3.1, Meritorious Claims and Contentions. It says, a lawyer shall not bring or defend a proceeding or assert or controvert an issue therein unless there is a basis in law and fact for doing so that it's not frivolous, which includes a good faith argument for an extension, modification, or reversal. I mean, in looking at that, someone could argue, well, the rule says that I get to see the pictures first, but, I mean, come on. That's, someone could argue that going this far, making it this much of an issue to do a writ, if a writ was actually filed, someone could argue that that was frivolous, because, I mean, it's just ridiculous. Okay, let's move on. We got the maternal aunt, Jane Weedland. She appeared at the shelter hearing, asked the judge to place Andy, only one of the kids, with her, and said she wasn't financially able to take Stuart. The judge orders the department to do a home study outside the courtroom. Carol, visibly upset, she walks up to the bailiff who was standing outside of the courtroom and said, Judge Houston is nuts. How can you stand working with him? Bayless just smiled and did not respond. Okay, so ethical professionalism, both. What's your comment? Okay, we're being recorded, and everyone is thinking that the guardian ad litem attorneys throughout the state think that's okay. That didn't get you to speak up. Come on.
Unprofessional.
Okay.
So this is 11.
All right.
Okay, and I think it's totally unprofessional.
Okay.
And
why?
Because you should never speak about a judge, a sitting judge, in that manner. And in addition, it looks really bad for the guardian ad litem program, and you're not representing your client professionally.
Okay.
That bailiff is going to go tell that judge you said that.
Exactly. You got to watch.
Hands down.
What you're doing. Even when the judge isn't around, those bailiffs know everything, don't they? All right. So is there an ethical issue? Saying something bad about a judge.
It is. I mean, that's calling somebody nuts would be libel per se, especially if somebody in the position of a judge. So, I mean, she's making a comment that could be actionable in court. So, I think without really a basis, you know. So, I think that is unethical. I think that crosses the line.
All right. Well, there was actually a case regarding this, and the Florida Bar had alleged two rule violations. One was the 4-3.5 sub C, conduct intending to disrupt a tribunal, and 4-8.4B, conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice. So, yeah. Don't talk about the judge. Don't say anything negative about the judge, or you're going to end up in big trouble. It's not to say that you have to agree to certain things that judges do or say, but you just have to watch out how you criticize the court, okay? The whole system, and the reason why this is such a serious issue is because you look in court and you see people dressed in T-shirts and flip-flops and things like that. That's showing a lot of disrespect to the court. And if we, as attorneys, officers of the court, show that disrespect, then the whole system begins to crumble. And I hope that y'all understand that. All right, so let's move on.
Notwithstanding the fact that truth may be a defense, you're also possibly committing slander. So that's something else that you would want to consider.
Oh, for sure. All right, thank you. Let's move on. Then Carol walks up to the CLS managing attorney and says, your attorney needs a lot of work. She didn't even know that the court can consider any evidence to the extent of its probative value at a shelter hearing. The managing attorney thanked Carol and said she would look into it. Ethics or professionalism problems with that?
I think that's professional. I mean, I don't even know that you know for sure that Gina didn't know that because Carol jumped in quickly.
Right. But what if, you know, Gina looked real hesitant and everything, so Carol jumps in to help her out.
Right.
Then goes to the managing attorney. Is that a problem going to the managing attorney?
I mean, professionally, I don't think it makes for a good working relationship. I can't think of anything ethics-wise off the top of my head, if somebody else can. But professional-wise, I mean, I just try and work with the CLS attorney. I mean, especially when mine first came into my county, I mean, she was pretty new. And I had, you know, been there for 5 years, actually, with DPS. So I knew what was going on. And, you know, she would always look back over her shoulder. She has this little sign. I don't even know if she does it. When she's floundering, she looks back over her shoulder or kind of gives me a look. And I jumped in with the answer. And it's kind of like a give and take, and it's a better working relationship, which isn't to say we agree on everything, because when we don't, we go round and round. But, you know, I kind of feel like that's in the best interest of the children for me to back that up when I need to.
Very, very good. The thing is, we're all in the same position, and we've all been in the same position at one point or another. We're all a team, and we all need to work together. And if there's someone on the team that needs help, you know, your comment was great. Help them. Help them. Say, Carol should say, Gina, you know, I saw that you were a little hesitant. Are you okay? Do you need any help? You know, would you, you know, I've been doing this for however many years. You know, do you have any, you know, if you have any questions or, you know, you want to get together before the hearings to prepare, you know, things like that. You don't go to write to someone's boss. How would you think if someone went to your boss after every hearing? You wouldn't like it. All right, so that's definitely a professionalism issue. Then we got Grace Wing was assigned as guardian and knew the children. And she had the children with her grandmother and believed that the mother was a good mother and that she was just involved with the wrong man. Is there a problem with that? Somewhat a volunteer guardian knowing the parent on the case.
Yes, that's a problem.
Okay.
Yes, it's a conflict. It's a conflict of interest.
So what's your duty as an attorney?
We have to identify it.
I go to my case coordinator and say we can't assign that. Can't assign that guardian. We need a different guardian.
Okay. All right, good. Definitely a potential conflict there. Like I said, a potential. It may not be an actual conflict, but we always want to avoid the potential. There was a dependency petition filed, court discussed an arraignment, and then outside the courtroom, before the arraignment, Carol sees Grace speaking with Belinda, James, Charles. They all join, sees them all join hands and praying together, and Carol just shakes her head and walks into the courtroom. While all the parties are present, but before the judge enters the courtroom, Carol approached the clerk and gave her a hug, and Carol thanked the clerk for helping her with a problem case. Okay, problems with that? Is there a problem with all these people talking to each other before the hearing, including the guardian and the mothers? Yes or no?
This is Kathy in the seventh. I mean, you know, the guardian volunteers will often talk with parents prior, you know, to an arraignment hearing, but for the attorney to observe them joining hands and praying together, that is something that they would have to take, I think, immediate action on.
Okay, and what's the immediate action?
To go and get the case coordinator and have them come out and ask the volunteer to separate from that group so that we could talk to her.
Good. And is there an appearance of conflict with guardian being with mom and her attorney and all joining hands and praying?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if there was a father present or any other parent present and they saw that, they're obviously going to have the immediate impression that this guardian volunteer is strictly on the side of the mother.
Right. And then, so there's Rule 4-4.2, communication with represented by counsel. Do you just let parents' attorneys be your guardians?
No.
No.
I've handled that by discussing it with Charles and advising them that he is not to discuss anything with.
Right. That's right. I mean, you got to point that out because, a minute, what happened? All right, let's move on. Belinda appears at the arraignment, denies the allegations. Gina presented the court with a home study on Spain. Her home study is denied because of some criminal arrests back in and 2001 and 2008. And then Charles, the parents' attorney, mother's attorney, was phone on mute.
Yeah, can somebody forgot to put their phone back on mute. We can hear the car and the wind.
Yeah.
We'll give it another second, and if it's still bad, David, I can just mute, and then we can unmute. There, I think they got it.
Hey, David, this is Kathy in the seventh again. Could I just go back for 1 second to that previous paragraph about the attorney going to the clerk and giving her a hug?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Yeah, because that is definitely, I think, inappropriate and unprofessional. And it actually occurred to me in a case that I had in my courthouse, and it, not with me. One of the relatives. It was a very hotly contested case, and it became obvious within the first couple of hearings that the clerk had the juvenile clerk had a private relationship or a friendship with one of the grandparents on, you know, belonging to, on one side. And they would frequently hug and, before the hearing would start. And my guardian volunteer didn't know who these people were at the time, and she said to me, that must be the person that the court likes because the clerk is hugging her.
Right, and our courtroom, the clerk said, as far as the parents think that everyone in the courtroom, you know, as far as the judge, that clerk is maybe the judge's assistant and is talking to the judge. And, again, there's that appearance of fairness and impropriety. So thanks a lot for bringing that up.
I will tell you that I chose to handle that. I went to the clerk privately, and I said to her that was, I thought, creating an inappropriate impression and that my own volunteers had noticed. And she got extremely insulted and gave me the cold shoulder treatment for literally months.
Well,
so
That's appropriate. You did. I mean, mainly if, I mean, bottom line is, as a rule of thumb, if you see that something's inappropriate, you know, just try and talk to the person about it in a, you know, professional, nice professional way.
Right. No, okay. I agree. That's the way to do it.
So, we have the Belinda's attorney requesting return of the children with a safety plan, or that the court override the home study on the Aunt Jane. And then the mom's attorney says, well, guardian ad litem agrees with this plan to send the kids back. And then Carol's shocked that she would recommend that the children be returned to the mom, but she didn't say anything. And then the attorney ad litem jumps up and says, Judge, although my clients want to return home, this is a dangerous situation. Please keep them in licensed shelter. And then DCF objects, and the judge says, hey, I know guardian ad litem, I'm going with her. So what are the ethics and professionalism issues in this situation? I mean, Carol obviously is concerned about the safety of these children, but her guardian is...
Yeah, the problem is that the guardian apparently had communications with the defense counsel to communicate the volunteer's position to Charles. So that would be an ethical violation if the defense counsel is talking to, you know, to the volunteer guardian without involving the Carol.
So how do you, okay, so that's a great point. How do you, as an attorney, prevent getting blindsided like Carol did?
I actually had something like that happen to me on one of my cases. Thank God, not in the middle of a hearing, but, you know, I got an email from DCF that says, oh, but the guardian ad litem is okay with permanent guardianship, and I'm like, whoa, wait a minute, you know, we want a TPR adoption. So, you know, you have to talk to the volunteers. I mean, most often they're lay people. They don't know about not having conversations with other attorneys or what the rules are about how attorneys are supposed to handle communications with parties that are represented or whatever. So that should be part of training. You know, when that happened to me with the email, I basically stated to DCF that that is not our position, that perhaps there was some miscommunication and that we need to have an internal staffing. I'll be back to them, and we addressed it. We did have an internal staffing with management where we discussed the situation and how to, you know, but thank God it wasn't in the middle of the hearing. This is a little bit more touchy, but if somebody just blurted out, hey, the guardian says blah, 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 I would, even in the middle of the hearing, basically state, well, this is not the position of the guardian ad litem program, and I don't know, maybe in this case ask for a brief recess and talk to the person, or, you know, but stop, not just roll, you know, let it go on if that's contrary to what you believe is right for the child.
Right. You got to do something. So I think that what you said was excellent, and that is you asked the judge for a recess, but the way to get the issue resolved. But the thing is that all our jobs as attorneys is to talk to our witnesses and people making recommendations in court prior to the hearing. That's all our obligations. And Carol would have talked to Grace before the hearing, this issue would have been resolved and
yes,
all ironed out.
Very
and
true.
Then what do you all think about Kathy saying, Judge, I know the kids want to go home, but this is dangerous?
Again, as attorney ad litem, it's her obligation to represent her clients that are the kids.
Hello?
And if the children express a desire to go home, she should, you know, it sounds like she's...
Well, I did up until I came home for this phone conference.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, it's someone talking on their phone.
I mean, I could see where maybe she's alarmed. She feels that this is a dangerous situation, but she is not representing her client's interest at this point.
Right.
Let me call this ethics conference.
And I think that, you know, the point that you brought up about, you know, taking it up the chain, you know, right away is the perfect way to deal with a situation. We are all in the business of making sure the kids are safe and protected. And we got to do everything in our power to make sure that that's done. All right, let's move on. We have then the CPI goes to Belinda, and what happens? Gordon's there, the home, and children are filthy, and there's more broken furniture, another hole in the wall indicating more domestic violence, and then there was another shelter hearing, and then here. Here we go again. Carol sees Grace, Belinda, and Jane, Charles speaking again. And then Jane, the aunt, walks up to Carol and says, hey, I got a great relationship with Andy. I've taken care of him my whole life. Yes, I smoked crack cocaine with Gordon and Belinda several years ago, but please request that Andy be placed with her. And Carol responded that she would do what she could. What are the issues here? Okay, well, I think that we already talked about that Carol should not be seeing Grace talking to Charles ever again, right, after the first time. So that issue should have been addressed, have been addressed. Also, what about Jane asking for assistance from Carol and Carol responding, I'll do what I can?
That's not ethical either, because it sounds like she's Carol is undertaking to represent Jane's interests in getting the child placed with her. But
right. That's Rule 4-4.3 in dealing with on behalf of a client with a person who is not represented by counsel, a lawyer shall not state or imply that the lawyer is disinterested. And
her obligation is to, you know, advocate for the best interest of the children, which, you know, doing what she can for the aunt is not, you know, advocating for the best interest of the children, and can lead the aunt to believe that somehow Carol is representing her now or representing her interests. So unethical.
How about in the conversation, Jane telling that she smoked crack cocaine and now Carol knows that? Is there any ethical or professional problem with that?
There's no confidentiality, so Carol should be telling whoever did the home study and DCF so that they're aware.
Right. There's really no problem with that. I mean, when you're doing witness prep, you get stuff like that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So let's move on. Grace approaches Carol and requested that Carol advocate for the return of the children, and that she just made a mistake. And Carol responds, are you nuts? Note that she likes saying that a lot. Are you nuts? There's no way I'm going to request this, and there's no way the judge is going to return the children to the mother. Okay, so is there a problem, ethical or professional, with that?
Well, obviously professional, because, again, we're back to this, are you nuts? And, you know, it's just not the right way to talk to a volunteer, you know, and not a right way to talk to anybody in a professional, you know, courtroom decorum type of a setting.
Can the attorney say there's no way that the judge is going to, this is going to fly with the judge?
No, that's...
Actually, the answer is yes. It's Rule 4-2.1, advisor in representing a client, a lawyer shall exercise independent professional judgment and render candid advice. Lawyer may not only refer to law, but other considerations.
Yes, yes, of course.
Okay. So,
I think I misunderstood your question before. I agree with what you said, totally.
All right. Well, I will give you full credit then. Thank you. All right. But you're doing a great job. I appreciate all the participation. All right, let's move on. While all the parties are in the courtroom, Charles, Carol, and Gina loudly discussed a past episode of Big Bang Theory. Their laughter subsided as the judge took the bench. In the hearing, Gina proffered the circumstance of the removal. Charles requested court return the children. Judge says to mom, I gave you a chance. You blew it. You're going to lose your parental rights someday. And then the mom bursts into tears, and Grace immediately goes over to Belinda and gives her a hug. Okay, so any problems with people in the courtroom with the judge not being there laughing about Big Bang Theory?
Probably not. I mean, it depends on who was in the courtroom and, you know, if...
Mom's there.
Yeah, there's a problem there then.
Yeah, that's unprofessional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We always need to show the parents because they won't take they will not take the process and the court seriously if we don't.
Yeah.
And
it could also give the mother the idea that they're in cahoots, you know, because they're laughing and, you know, it appears probably a little bit too jovial, you know.
How about with the judge, what the judge said, you know, I gave you a chance, you're going to lose your rights. Is there anything that Carol should have done when the judge said that, or is that okay for the judge to say?
I don't like the way he said it, but I mean... The judge, I mean, I have seen judges say to them, you know, if you continue down this path, you know, that's an option. That's something they have to be made aware of, and there's a way to do it. I don't like the way he did it, like a threatening tone, but they need to be advised that if you continue down this path, the department will file a termination of parental rights petition. They could lose the rights to their children. I mean, it is a possibility.
Very good. How about Grace going to Belinda and giving her a hug?
Again, that's it gives the impression that there's some bias or some relationship between the two that doesn't look professional. And
it's the same problem with the praying together and the holding hands and all that.
Right. So let's move on. Now we have Charles requesting that Andy be placed with Jane, and Carol states that Jane has been a caregiver for years, was financially not able to provide care for Stuart. And then the attorney ad litem and the DCF attorney object, and the court placed Andy with Jane. And any problems with that?
I think one of the problems would be failing to disclose that information about Jane smoking crack or doing cocaine or whatever she did with the parents before.
Is there a misrepresentation being made by Carol by not mentioning that?
Yes.
Yeah.
But
and a failure to represent her client, which is the Guardian program.
Is that? Are you,
and a failure to adequately represent her client.
So because she knows that about this past crack cocaine issue, is she obligated
right.
to tell that to the court?
I think it's material, and that they also don't discuss whether a home study was done. So,
yeah,
right. Well,
so yeah, it would certainly be a material part of a home study.
Right.
I mean, it's hard on this one because it's hard to imagine this scenario because I can't imagine not staffing this. You know, when there's a denied home study and you know about the crack cocaine and you haven't stopped it with the guardian and you haven't stopped it with your child advocacy coordinator because there's a whole best interest that you announced that you haven't made and the children are going to be separated. So you have to go through that whole analysis. So it's hard to answer that, but I would just blurt out that she did crack cocaine. I mean, I feel like I probably would blurt that out because I wouldn't be asking for the children to be placed with her in that regard. So I'm not sure how it would play out if I was asking them to be placed with that information. But it feels wrong.
I agree. You know, it seems to me that at this point, Carol stopped representing the best interests of the children and started representing.
Right.
Because,
okay.
You know, there should be some, you know, arguments about not separating siblings or, you know, it just,
right.
You know.
There's a team there.
Yeah.
Right. That's an excellent point. All right, we got to move on because we're
doing so well.
Hitting the time crunch. You can still participate, though. Mm-hmm. Outside of the courtroom in front of Gina, high-fives Carol. She gets a hug from Jane. And then Grace tells Carol that she's given stuff to Jane. So would you agree, everyone agrees that that's definitely an appearance, high-fiving the mother's attorney? That's not showing impartial, that you're impartial. And also, the guardian, how about the guardian given Jane Sims? Is that a problem? Doesn't the guardian help out with giving kids stuff sometimes?
Yeah, all the problems. That's certainly in the best interest of the children for him to have a bed to sleep on.
Okay. All right. So then Carol goes into the courtroom and says, I want to apologize for the other day. I was having a bad day. But, you know, Grace, I know she means well, but she's crazy, and she's going to get her child killed someday. And there was no way I was going to argue that the kids be returned to this horrible mother, even though Grace wanted me to. And then Judge accepts the apology, apologized for throwing the pictures, and thanked her for preventing a mistake. What's the problem with that?
Number one is ex parte.
Right, Rule 4-3.5. You can't talk about with the judge about the substance of the case. What else?
You know, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, calling the guardian, the volunteer, crazy and that she's going to get a child killed. Again, these are, you know, these are slanderous or libelous announcements that, you know, it's certainly not professional at the very least to be talking about your own, you know, like your own volunteer, the person you're representing in this fashion to the judge, you know, the ex parte, discussing the conversation between the volunteer and the guardian. I mean, there's the confidentiality of the attorney-client's communication that's, I think, being violated over here.
Right. Very good. Yep.
Not only that, I mean, we have a duty to the program. If we do have a concern about the guardians and it's this severe, because I'm not saying it's severe. I'm saying what Carol said is that severe that the child could be killed. We have a duty to go back to the program and go to the child advocacy coordinator and the director and say, wait, we have a problem with this guardian and what she's recommending.
Right. Very good. Excellent comments.
So take care of it.
Great. Right. Then we have the trial. 5 minutes before the trial, Carol doesn't see any witnesses out the courtroom and asks the DCF attorney, how come there's no witnesses? And the DCF attorney said, I can just prove it through the mom. And Carol tells the Gina, should have subpoenaed Jane. She told me she used crack with the parents. Gina says, you know, I'm sorry. I just don't agree with you. I don't need her. So Carol's scared that the judge would deny the petition if the mom denies on the witness stand that she abused any drugs. But she also knew that the judge will punt the case at a drop of a hat and continue it. So Carol says, I want a continuance. I didn't get discovery from Gina, and I want to subpoena someone. And then the judge continues the case, and then Grace told Carol, hey, I wanted the trial to occur. Why do we need a continuance? And Carol says, hey, I'm the attorney. Please let me do my job. Then Gina goes up to Carol and says, thanks for throwing me under the bus. I looked at my file, you never requested discovery. And Carol says, he should thank me. I saved your behind. Okay, so what are the issues in this? We're almost done.
The biggest one I see is Carol is lying to the judge by saying that she needs a continuance because she didn't receive discovery from Gina.
Right, that's candor towards the tribunal, Rule 4-3.3. And what other problems are there?
I'll be quiet. I talk too much.
What? No, it's okay. But what other issues are here, too?
Carol should have subpoenaed her own witness. You know, why would she be relying on DCF to feel that somebody's important? You know that they're not on the subpoena. She should have requested discovery from Gina. She would have known who was subpoenaed, who wasn't, and if they weren't, she could do it herself.
That's right. I mean, everyone's got an obligation to prepare for trial. And the thing was, is that Carol wasn't prepared for trial.
Yes.
So, that's just simple. Rule 4-1.1 competence. And also, you know, there is... How about the issue where Carol just asked for the continuance without talking to the guardian? Is there ethical or professional problem with that?
I like to keep my guardians informed of everything we're doing, even if it's a legal issue. I tell them what the issue is. I tell them how I want to resolve it. I mean, 99% of the time, they go with me. I don't even remember one time where they said, no, that, you know, I don't agree with that. You know, it's like a team. Yes, it's a legal issue, but we're a team. It's like saying to them, hey, I have to go in. I have to ask for a continuance. She didn't subpoena her witnesses. You know, I didn't know she wasn't going to subpoena the witnesses. You know, whatever the story is, you know, you tell them.
Very good. It's always best to communicate frequently and well ahead of time before any hearing. Then Grace, because of this, she just drops out of the case. And there's no guardian. And then the court finally does the trial. Carol thinks that Belinda is weak and she's going to cave when Carol cross-examines her. And then Carol says, you're a good mother. Do you think a good mother exposes her children to domestic violence? Belinda bursts into tears. Charles asks for a recess. They consent. The court accepts the consent and goes right to disposition. And the case plan requires the mother to complete a lot of tasks. But then Carol says that the case plan has to require that Belinda have a psychological evaluation and any recommended treatment. Charles objects, and the judge asks Carol for the basis, and Carol says the mother has a history of substance abuse and involvement in unhealthy relationships. She's unable to file court orders. The court granted the request. So, was there anything unprofessional or unethical what Carol did knowing that Belinda would cave on cross?
I don't like the way she worded her questions. I mean, those are arguments to make before the judge, because that's not, you know, good parenting, letting them observe domestic violence. There's other ways to word those questions. So I would think those were unprofessional questions. There are ways to word that without doing it in that manner.
Okay. Does everyone agree with that? Anybody have a different opinion?
I don't think it's a problem.
Okay. And you don't think it's probably don't think it's a problem that and not to put words in your mouth, but you don't have a problem at the technique knowing that mom's going to cave. So
absolutely, that's your job. I mean,
what's a trial?
If you're in a trial and you know as an attorney that you can accomplish the objective that's in your client's best interest and you're not doing anything dishonest, I don't understand why aggressive advocacy is a problem.
Okay. All right. Well, this is a great discussion. Also, how about tacking on the psych eval at the disposition hearing with no notice to anybody?
I think that's a problem,
Okay, go ahead.
I did think that was a problem, but Charles kind of didn't argue the due process issue. I think they should have taken testimony as to that. That was not a legal argument. I mean, there is a legal argument to be made about adding that, but I think you need testimony to back it up. So even though the trial is not going forward as to the consent, when you have a problem or dispute on the case plan tab, I think you're setting yourself for a bad appealable issue if you don't put evidence on why that task should be added.
Okay, but how about bringing it up at the dispo without telling anybody?
I don't have a problem with that. I mean, let me just say this. I mean, I always think it's better to ask for something, and somebody can object and somebody can tell you no, but if people don't do that, I don't know why you can't try to accomplish something that needs to happen. Everybody's represented by counsel. Everybody's grown up in there.
You can reset it. But he didn't say, I wasn't noticed that you were going to ask for that.
Okay, so, but what I'm saying is there an ethical or professional problem about not providing, letting anybody know that you were going to say that?
I don't think so under the facts of this scenario, because the case was set for trial, the parent decided to consent, and the judge went forward with the disposition hearing at that hearing. So there was no
option.
All right. But would everyone agree that it's best just being up front and maybe asking for a recess or something and just say, hey, I looked at this case plan, but we're going to ask that the judge add a psych eval? Yes?
Well, I'm probably operating from the position that we always ask for a psych eval, so everybody in the room knows I'm going to ask for a psych eval. Maybe I'm just operating from that position.
And if we had a settlement, we probably have discussed it, and they didn't agree to the case plan, and the department didn't add it, but I'm saying? It wouldn't have been the first time we're discussing it, usually.
Okay.
This is Liza Ritchie from the 13th.
Hey.
Hi. I think the issue here is that given that when you ask for a psych eval, you have a certain standard that you have to prove, I think the issue is that it should have been noticed. I don't think it's appropriate to bring it up without a motion or notice. So I do think there is an ethical and a professional issue with simply trying to tack it on at the disposition hearing.
Good. All right.
I have
dispositional hearing. Yeah, we gotta wrap it up. So y'all have done a great job with this scenario and identifying the ethical and professional issues. Y'all bring up a lot of great points and demonstrate your professionalism and high value of ethics. Now, for the most important things, who is Belinda Carlisle? Who is she? For real.
She was in the Go-Go's.
Right. Who is Gordon Sumner?
Sting.
That's right, Sting. Who's Andy Summers?
That one I don't know.
Is he from the police?
He's a guitarist in the police. Who's Stuart Copeland?
He was at the police.
He was drummer to police. Who's Jane Wheeldon?
Go-Go's.
The Go-Go's. And how about Charlotte Caffey?
The same, I think.
She was in the Go-Go's also. How about Grace Wing? Who is that?
Oh, isn't she? No.
I'm showing my age, sorry.
I was thinking Grace Slick. You had me confused.
That's Grace Slick. And who's Carole King?
Well,
Who is Gina Schock?
She's a drummer from the Go-Go's, I think.
That's right. And how about Kathy? Kathy Valentine was also in the Go-Go's. How about Charles Watts?
Rolling Stones.
Yeah, drummer.
That's right. Going on tour soon. And who is Paul Hewson?
That's Bono, isn't it?
That's right, that's Bono. All right, well, you did a fantastic job. I don't feel alone in my love for classic rock.
No, you're not.
So thank you very much for your participation. Mary Kay, you want to say anything?
I just want to thank everybody. That was great. And also, the thing about it going over is we're going to have enough time to get 1.5 credits.
Yeah!
So that's great.
Woo!
Turn that out. We don't have the number yet, right?
No, we don't have it yet.
Okay, perfect.
But it'll be. I'll send it out to all the supervising attorneys and the directors, and then it'll also be posted on the website as soon as we get it.
Do you know how long that's going to take?
A long time.
I have an April 30th deadline. Oh, shucks.
What's your deadline?
April 30th.
Oh, yeah, there's no way. I mean, it takes the bar sometimes 3 to 4 months.
Okay.
It's
funny because that's exactly what I needed. Y'all.
You can email me, and there's lots of free ethics credits all over the internet, so.
All right, well.